Jack Welch. Professor Welch is the Robert K. Thomas Professor of Law here at BYU, and for many years, editor of BYU Studies. On a personal note, I can say I first met Jack as a young man who was returning to the United States from Salzburg by way of Oxford. I was able to see him at Oxford. I first met him there and spent a few days just learning about life at Oxford University when he was a Danforth scholar there. Professor Welch's presentation today is going to be about Leviticus as a temple template. Okay.
Well, thank you for the applause. I guess I can go home now. I really do appreciate being here, and Stephen and Don, thank you for being insistent and twisting my arm to have something to contribute to this conference. I do look forward to sharing with you some ideas on Leviticus, which has been, beside its legal content, its chiastic structures and organization has been something that has fascinated me for a long time. It's been wonderful to hear so many of the things that Stephen and Don and I have worked on in the past, bearing fruit, good fruit at the end of a long allegory, and books like Isaiah and the Book of Mormon that Don and I worked on, and the King Benjamin speech that Stephen and I did, and other things. The our book on the allegory of the olive tree, I was just talking to Don about, you know, back in the early 90s, we were just still thinking about how to raise good olive trees. And we liked a line that Brother Nibley used a lot, which was, when I remember him saying this when I was in a freshman Book of Mormon class that he was teaching, whoever wrote Jacob chapter 5 knew everything you need to know to raise good olives in the Eastern Mediterranean. And I think today we can begin to see that anyone who wrote Jacob chapter 5 knew anything you would need to know to understand the temple of ancient Israel, too. Wonderful contributions, and I appreciate them. Now, in my 20 minutes today, I'm going to try to cover the entire book of Leviticus. Okay, well, but I just want to explore a few ideas about seeing the book of Leviticus as an archetype of a temple template. Typically, when the topic of Leviticus is raised in polite company, it is usually greeted with quizzical squints, if not blaring glares. How many of you would claim the book of Leviticus as your favorite book in the Bible? Not even. Yeah, okay. I've got one vote, I know. Okay. But, no, really, the you know, if Leviticus has been your least favorite book, and maybe it has something to do with how many Sunday school lessons we have been asked to teach over the years in the Old Testament curriculum on Leviticus. Can any of you think of any of them? Oh, okay. That maybe if it hasn't been your favorite, I hope that there will be a decided change today on that, and maybe it will become one of your more favorites. 20 years ago, building on Brother Nibley's appendix in the message of the Joseph Smith Papyri, I offered an initial definition of what a temple text might be. Of course, it has to do with covenantal underpinnings of ceremonies, symbols, purposes, vocabulary, also the construction of temples, ceremonies of the temple, and a number of clues may signal to the reader that a text has temple connotations. And as we've seen today, and plenty of work that Margaret Barker has done, the strength and number of those clues is growing excitedly. I mean, there's a lot going on. And, you know, since several of us have been looking for temple patterns in other places, such as the Sermon on the Mount, the Book of Job, Moses, Book of Moses, chapters 1 to 7, Malachi, Jacob 5, and so on, to what we might begin to wonder as we're seeing more and more of these patterns and places where temple texts are coming to light, to what source might we best turn for an explanation of this recurring pattern? Well, we may want to look to the Pentateuch. And, you know, there sometimes it's unclear. It's not always easy to say this is a temple text. We have to argue for it. Maybe it is. Maybe some of the points are convincing. Some of them aren't. But in the case of the book of Leviticus, you'd think if any book is a temple text, Leviticus has got to be it. It is all about the temple. It's a very complex book. Jacob Milgram's three volumes, if you haven't become best friends with those three volumes, I recommend that you do. Obviously, we can't cover all of that today, but I think, to use the mother tree analogy, I think that the book of Leviticus may well be the mothership of all temple texts in the biblical tradition. So let me begin with my trademark. Because I think the temple is at the center of the cosmos of the biblical world. And I don't think it's accidental that the book of Leviticus does stand at the heart of the Pentateuch. It is the central book of the first five books of the Bible. The similarities between Genesis and Deuteronomy have been elaborated by many scholars, Callum Carmichael in particular. The style and narrative of the wandering in Israel and the makeup of the book of Exodus and Numbers, these just are two matching pillars surrounding the central book of Leviticus. I've thought of Leviticus this way since the early 1970s, when Yehuda Radai sent me a draft of his chapter on chiasmus in Hebrew narrative for inclusion in the volume Chiasmus in Antiquity. There he argued, and you can read a couple pages of his reasoning, I think very persuasively, that Leviticus is at the apex of this ABCBA chiasm. He went on to say, Leviticus occupies the central position in the Torah, where whether or not the modern reader likes it, the commandments occupy the ultimate position of prominence. And this idea has been observed by others, such as Angelico DeMarco and Dwayne Christensen. A corroboration of the idea that chiasmus has something to do with the positioning and structure of Leviticus is, I'll just give you the first of more than a dozen pages in the Chiasmus Index on the Chiasmus Resources website. Leviticus has some of the most elaborate and detailed instances of chiasmus. And Jacob Milgram makes use of this over and over again. One of my favorite examples of chiasmus in the Old Testament is Leviticus chapter 24, the case of the slayer, the blasphemer and his punishment. And that's been used in our literature for quite a while. But it's typical, and I think the fact that we see chiasmus at the molecular level in the organization of this book corroborates the fact that the overall structure of this book, and as well as its position in the Pentateuch, is significant. This is the text of Leviticus 24, and it has to do, of course, with the breach for breach, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And we'll come back to this text in a few minutes because it stands in a very significant position, being one of only two narrative texts in the whole book of Leviticus. So let's think about the main themes. Just looking very broadly at what we have here. For one thing, I think it's quite clear that the book of Leviticus is an ascension text, and most temple texts are. It begins with something basic. It begins and moves forward to more complex and higher ranges of spirituality, of holiness, eventually culminating in chapters 25 to 27 in the pinnacle of the objectives of the Law of Moses. But it begins with the Law of Sacrifice in chapters 1 through 5. And the interesting thing here to me is that not only does it set forth a lot of requirements for sacrifice, different kinds of things are to be sacrificed, burnt offerings, cereal offerings, well-being offerings, purification offerings, graduated purification offerings, depending on who has committed the transaction, reparation offerings. And we get weary with all of these requirements, but these provisions make it very clear that many things, in fact, almost everything, can and should be sacrificed to the Lord, that all that we have been given is covered by the Law of Sacrifice here. And it affects all parts of life, as it invites temple worshipers to bring all kinds of sacrifices into the storehouse of the Lord. Sacrifices are to be offered under all kinds of conditions, whether under sickness or in health, well-being or impurity, in good standing before the Lord, or in need of forgiveness and the reestablishment of a righteous relationship with God. Out of all of that which the Lord has blessed his people, they shall make sacrifices. How many of you know what comes in chapters 6 and 7? I assume you know Leviticus? No. Okay. I won't make that assumption. But starting in chapter 5 and chapter 6, we often think of these laws as just being mechanical things, but they actually do penetrate to the essence of spirituality. Chapter 5 is interesting. It begins by putting upon everyone a burden, a duty, that if you know that any law has been transgressed, you have to report your fellow Israelite so that that can be handled properly, because there's a corporate sense of liability under Israelite law. We all suffer if anyone is not in good standing with the Lord. And I really like that idea that we are our brother's keepers in a way. We all are in this together. And it's not that we're tattling on people, but we're all mutually involved in building Zion and oneness, that unity. It's not going to just happen unless we work together. But the obligation is not just that we report any transgressions that we see, but we must also confess any transgressions that we have committed. So there's the step of repentance that leads the way to any kind of sacrifice that's going to work a redemption or reconciliation. So there's a principle of what we do to make these sacrifices efficacious through our temple observances. Starting in chapter 6, we learn particularly that, 6. Okay, 6, 7, and 8. Once again, PowerPoint is proven to be not flawless. Okay, chapter 6. These ordinances must be carried out with precision. The rules and regulations require the perpetual burning of the fire on the altar all night long and all day, all of the day and all of the night. With precision, we have to obey the law. And if a person eats any of these sacrifices, being unclean, the punishment is that a person will be cut off. In other words, as we enter into this relationship with God, there are penalties, there are consequences for the violation of these laws. Joseph Smith once said, I'm not a righteous person. God will judge everyone according to the degree of light and knowledge that they have. He said, I've got a lot of light and knowledge. He was pretty worried. Am I as righteous as I should be? Well, the same kind of gradation is found in Leviticus. As you have more responsibility, as you progress through the book, the punishments or the penalties become more and more severe. So we have next then, I should have had on here the law of obedience, because it goes hand in hand with the practices of sacrifice. So following sacrifice and obedience, in chapter 8, we have the inauguration of priestly administration and how the priests are set up to have particular responsibilities, and having complied with the law of sacrifice and obedience, then we have ordination of people to the power of the priesthood. I think this is an important indication that this book is not being written chronologically. This is typological. We're seeing a framework, because how could you have all the sacrifices in chapters 1-7 unless you had priests already? So it's a principle that's being taught. And once we are prepared, then there are those who have the priesthood who can then ordain people to the priesthood. So this is a pattern that I think is meaningful. And in the ordination, of course, you have in chapter 8 at the beginning, robing in garments, anointing with oil, washing with water, placing on the priests a coat, a girdle, a robe, the mitre, a golden plate, not one of the Nephite plates, but gold plate that has the name of Yahweh on it, so that he takes upon himself the name of God, literally, as God's representative on earth. And he is also presented with a holy crown, representing his power and kingship. Blood is put upon the tip of his right ear, on his right thumb, and on the big toe of his right foot. Body parts are anointed so that his whole body is prepared. His head is then anointed, and he is then prepared to officiate priesthood ordination, and the importance of this is significant. Now, in chapter 10, we have a very odd story, which is which pertains to the requirement of really strict obedience on the part of these priests. And this is the story of Aaron's two sons who offer an unlawful sacrifice, and they die. It's a bit like the rebellion of Korah later in the book of Numbers. But the point is that obedience to these ordinances is important, and it must be carried out strictly. Of course, after the death of those two brothers, the other sons of Aaron are put under more instructions so that this won't happen again, but penalties for disobeying, misusing any of these priesthood powers is then guarded against. Okay, what happens in chapters 11 to 16. In the next section, we have a series of laws regarding purity in daily life, such as eating, the kosher laws, what you can eat and what you can't eat, childbirth, cleansing of the child, the woman after childbirth, washing, skin diseases, sexual discharges. This is all ordinary life stuff. This is out in the village. But the importance of the home and the village is that you must be pure in order to be able to come back and enter into the temple. Who shall ascend into the mountain of the Lord? Psalm 24 begins. He who hath clean hands and a pure heart. It's not just it's the broken heart and a contrite spirit, but the clean hands and the law of purity has to operate there as well. And then chapter 16, probably the one chapter that most people know, is the expulsion of impurity. It's obvious that if we have all of these rules of purity, there has to be a way in which any transgression of that law can be rectified. One of the most important principles of the gospel is that things will get broken, but when they are broken, they can be fixed. And the chapter 16 is the ritual regarding the two goats, and notice that one of them is a goat that is sacrificed to the Lord for an atonement, but then you also have the sacrifice of the goat for Azazel, and a strong man will take that goat out. You transfer all of the impurities of the people to that goat, and he will be the scapegoat that escapes, that takes this all of this impurity away from us. Well, we're talking here about kind of this world and how we live on a daily life. And it's in that context that it's important that if we are going to reach a state of purity and to be purified from all impure and unholy practices, we have to get rid of the influence of the devil, of Satan. We must drive him out of this world before we can then progress the next step. Jacob Milgram, talking about this, says, and there are many interpretations that have been offered for what this scapegoat represents. He says, the most plausible explanation is that Azazel is the name of a demon who has been eviscerated in his erstwhile demonic powers by the priestly legislators. So we have here, I think, an important thing. Now, I think it's important, what I want to do next is, at this stage, to introduce to you a floor plan of the temple, or the tabernacle. They're basically the same. You recognize this with the outer court, the altar, the brazen sea, or the laver. And then you have the smaller room, the hekal, the holy place, and eventually the Holy of Holies. What you have between the outer court and the holy place is a screen, a type of veil. And of course, a second screen separates the holy place from the Holy of Holies. The ordinary priests can go in through the first screen, only the high priest through the second screen. Mary Douglas has written a book on Deuteronomy, and by the way, Jacob Milgram thinks very highly of it. So do I. In it, she says, you have to understand that the book of Leviticus has the floor plan of the temple in mind. All that you see in chapters 1 through 7 on the right side here of the screen, deal with what happens at the altar. And we are now kind of going around, circumnavigating the altar in the middle. Skipping over 8, 9, and 10, that's the first screen, which is the story about the death penalty. That's the first narrative in the book of Leviticus. And it's distinguished then from 11 through 16, and actually 17 to the end of the instructions on sacrifice, with other things that happen in the outer court. Now, whether they all happen in the order that makes any sense or not isn't the big point. I think Mary Douglas is right that all of the things involved with chapters 1 through 17 are clearly centered physically in the outer court. And what happens next in her construction is you go through that veil and you encounter chapters 18, 19, and 20. Chapters 18 and 20 are a matched pair. Now, these are the laws relating to incest, adultery, any kind of sexual violations, or abuses of children by offering them to Molech. This is basically sexual relations in the family. This is chastity. And we have these twin pillars. Chapter 18, more or less laying out all of the thou shalt nots, and it's an abomination to do all of these things. Chapter 20 will add all of the penalties, especially those that will be divinely imposed. Mary Douglas says, visually as an anthropologist, I see these two chapters like twin pillars on a pediment of a temple, and across the pediment is chapter 19, the center point, the holiness code. This is the one that centers on thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And this is all of the laws about how you behave, going beyond just the law of sacrifice. Now we're talking about community and how you live, being honest to your fellow man, not having weights that are divergent in your own bag. You go through the laws. Of course, Leviticus 19 was one of the chapters that Jesus quoted more than any other. So I won't read all of this except to, maybe just quote from Mary Douglas here. These two pillars are so strikingly similar in content and frame as to emphasize the all-important chapter 19, which has been widely recognized as the middle, the very center of Leviticus, and indeed the epicenter of the Pentateuch. So, Now we've moved into a stage where only the priests go. So these higher regulations are applicable. In chapter 21 and 22, you have rules about what the priests must do for them to be clean and be able to offer the daily sacrifice of the shewbread, which only takes place here in that part of the temple, and how their families can only eat of the food that that is holy, that the priests can bring home, so that they do not defile the temple or themselves by eating unworthily. Chapter 23 talks about the menorah. Chapter 24 is about the lights in the temple. 23 is all about the daily, about the festival calendar, the holy days, and how the order of what's going on in the temple on a terrestrial calendar will relate to the heavens above, so that everything is being done synchronically with the heaven above. And then we come to 24, the case of the blasphemer, the other narrative, and people wonder, what on earth is that story doing here in the book of Leviticus? But what's the problem here? The person who is being put to death has blasphemed the holy name of God. And the one thing that must be absolutely protected if you're going to go into the Holy of Holies is keeping the name of God absolutely pure. Because it's now representative of your whole relationship, not with other people, which is what is involved with the Hekal, but your relationship with God himself. And so you pass through this other screen that acts as a warning and as a barrier. Anybody who comes here who in any way blasphemes or misrepresents, and remember the whole high priest has that name on his head, and he's the one who's being warned and reminded that just like what happened when the sons of Aaron violated their obligations, well, guess what's going to happen to you if you desecrate the name of God. And that then leaves I've kind of gotten away from this, haven't I? But finally, we go to the chapters 25 to 26. And here in chapters 25 to 27, just let me, because my time is almost up now, just briefly say that what you find in these two chapters are the laws relating to the sabbatical and jubilee years, when everything becomes perfect, when all people become reconciled, when all debts are forgiven, when slaves are liberated. It even uses the terminology of consecrating. But here you encounter the law of consecration, atonement, family, redeeming the land of members of your family who have become poor and have lost their land, redeeming people who have made personal vows and now need to be able to cover the obligations that they made there, dedicating or consecrating your home, consecrating your fields, and consecrating your animals, and paying tithing on all the land. Did you know that those were things that were in Leviticus 25 and 27? Well, it's all based on the idea that all of the land belongs to God. It is all his land. We are simply stewards in charge of using it to his glory and his benefit. Chapter 26, once again, you've got kind of two pillars, 25 and 27, surrounding the central chapter 26, which is, first of all, a chapter of all kinds of blessings, and then culminating in God promising that he will remember the covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Here in the Holy of Holies, what do you find? The blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And as Mary Douglas says, we go through all this mystery and we find, as we get to the end, it's no mystery at all. It's the open promise that God has made to all of us who will enter into this covenant and will abide by the principles of it, that we may be then blessed with all of the blessings that Jacob, Isaac, and Abraham were given. Of course, chapter 26 also has an equal number of curses. So this idea of blessing and curse is prominent throughout all temple material. You're rising to a high level of responsibility, and violations will be, of course, punished with that. So I want to end, and if I could do this, I would jump real quickly over, this is the floor plan of the synagogue in Sepphoris in Galilee. And it's interesting, notice that this synagogue was built by people from the tribe of Levi, and that this mosaic was paid for with dedications, and so we know who they were, and they were very clear about making it known that they were Levites. This is a Byzantine 5th century synagogue, but notice that there are seven panels as you go down, and they have to do with the temple, as this is the floor plan of the temple. And you can see as you begin at the top, you have the world, and you're coming out of the world where the animals and the creation exist. But you go from there through the gate of the temple in the middle with the menorah lighting the way. And you then meet the brazen sea and the animals being brought for sacrifice. This is what it actually looks like on the floor, fairly well preserved after all these years. What you're seeing there in the middle is the table of the shewbread and the first fruits and other things that pertain to the priestly functions in the Heikal. This is the... you then come to this great... It looks like a zodiac, but it is positioned on this floor plan where the veil of the temple is found. And based on what Josephus says about the veil of the temple, it has on it the sun and the moon and the stars and all of that. And why? So that we can have our ritual consonant with the heavens. This is Leviticus chapter 23, to connect with the holy days and the seasons on the four corners of this. There you can see the schematic. And finally, my last point, which people have puzzled over and say, what on earth? If that's the veil of the temple, then these last three scenes must have to do something with the Holy of Holies. But what's this? Well, on the left you have Abraham and Isaac, with Abraham taking Isaac to Mount Moriah for the binding of Isaac, and you have the ram. You can see the head of the ram, fortunately, just here to, you got it right here. So you can know that this is the release of Isaac. So you have the sacrifice and the covenant that God makes then with Abraham. And here you have Sarah and a scene that is typical of Abraham and Sarah feeding the three visitors. There would have been three of them here as messengers of God who come to give them the promises. Why is this in the Holy of Holies? Does it belong there? Leviticus chapter 26 certainly would confirm that. So, with that, let me ask, how many of you now think Leviticus is a little more interesting than when we started? Okay. You get this framework in mind and read it carefully. You'll find treasures, mysteries, wonderful things that will open up. And how many of you think this, after all, if everybody, including Zenas, is strictly obeying the law and the temple there, this may well be the mothership that we've been looking for. Thanks very much.